I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The beginning of the end for the family farmer. Or the beginning of the end of unfair subsidies that distort world trade and hold back US exporters. Whichever it is, the deal done by world trade negotiators at the weekend matters to us all, farmers and non-farmers alike. According to one estimate, if world trade barriers were reduced by just one third, then on average, every American family would be better off by $2,500 a year. Lower subsidies mean lower barriers, and lower barriers mean more exports. At least, that's the theory. But just what that means for the farmers and for the price of the food we buy are questions that loom large. What do you think? In this election year, how important are considerations about America's farmers? In swing states with important agricultural bases like Iowa, Ohio, and Minnesota, will farming trump other issues at the ballot box? If you grow food or eat food, what are your thoughts about the idea that farmers could soon be getting up to 20% less in government subsidies? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, I'd like to introduce now my first guest this hour. He is George Naylor, who farms some 470 acres of corn and soybeans in west central Iowa. George, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, paint a picture for us, if you would. What's it like these days farming? Well, it's pretty much an average kind of size farm, isn't it, in the current economic environment?
Well, it's getting my farm's getting to be one of the smaller or medium-sized farms in our community because farmers have been trying to get bigger to stay in business. A lot of farmers have quit. And instead of having diversified farms like we used to, where we've had livestock on the farms and the whole family was involved, unfortunately, the livestock production has shifted to big family factory farms. And so what's happened then is farmers have switched over just to grain and corn and soybeans. And I have very few neighbors anymore. It's a really sad thing for our local communities.
You inherited the farm, I think, didn't you, from your dad? How does your life compare to his?
Well, you know, he always told me that if I wanted to come back to the farm, that would be great with him because farming was the best life in the world. But he also wanted me to get a college education because he knew that farming was always a tenuous occupation, and especially if your society and your government wasn't supporting family farmers. And it's been really about 30 years since we've had any kind of good support for family farmers.
Now, the conversation increasingly these days is about subsidies, about the support that the government gives, and now the idea that that support may, over a period of time, be reduced quite substantially. Is that an important consideration for you?
Well, yes, it is, because I'm raising corn and soybeans. Those are two major program crops. And the thing that people need to understand is that even with the subsidies, we would get the equivalent of less than the cost of production. And besides that, they have to realize, too, the only reason we need the subsidies is because the price of corn and soybeans and wheat and cotton and rice, for instance, are so very low generally. And it's because of the world pricing of these, the international pricing of these commodities, which is part of this free trade mania. And so when prices are so low, if it wasn't for the little bit of subsidy we get, well, just about every farmer would quit farming tomorrow.
Can you give us some idea of how big a proportion the government subsidy is of your annual family income compared to what you get by just selling what you grow on the market?
Right. Well, it's because I own most of my land, it's a smaller percentage of, like, it's probably around a third. But for farmers that are renting land, a lot of the land, which is very typical now, farmers generally don't even own their own farm or own a very small portion of it. It can be 50%. In some years, it can be 100%. In some years, it's not even enough to cover the cost of their production.
Okay, but let's try and spell this out. On your operation, about one-third of the money that goes into your bank account every year comes from government. About two-thirds comes from what you can sell on the market. Take away that one-third that comes from government. Suppose that were to disappear. Could you still support a family?
Well, it'd be very difficult. Already, my wife had to go to work in town because the cost of health insurance kept going up year after year. So she really needed to get a job where her employer helps pay for health insurance. Our premiums were reaching $1,000 a month. And so there was just not enough money to pay for that. And so she had to go to work. And so the whole idea of our family farm where we're all involved, you know, just went out the window. And that's generally the case for all farmers in our community.
But not only for farmers, is it? I mean, that idea of a two-income family is now increasingly prevalent. It doesn't only apply to people who work in agriculture.
No, that's right. But, you know, if everybody in the family isn't participating in the on the farm, you know, you can be sure that the character of the type of farming that goes on that farm is going to change drastically. And the type of farming is going to shift towards an industrialized model where we are more reliant on chemicals. And, you know, it's just basically you plant your crop and kill the weeds and harvest. And that, you know, otherwise, that's your only main consideration anymore.
You have two sons, I think, don't you, George?
Yes, I do. I have an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old.
Do you think that they will take over the farm from you?
Well, I hope that they have that opportunity if that's what they would like. They would have to have sort of an idealistic vision of what life on the farm could be like. The way trends are going, the only way that would happen is if we change this free trade policy and our farm policy, or if they were able to somehow generate a market from the consumers where the consumers were willing to pay a higher price for food, for the good quality food that was produced in the right way by family farmers. And, of course, that's very difficult.
What we're being told now is that if these subsidies are reduced, then the benefit that comes together with that in the package is that barriers elsewhere are lowered. It'll be easier for Americans, both farmers and others, to export their produce, and that is a benefit for everybody. Can you see in any way a benefit for you?
No, absolutely not. That's a myth. I mean, I don't export anything. I sell my grain into the market. Big corporations like Cargill are the ones that export. And besides that, my price isn't really determined by how much the United States exports or uses. It's really determined by how much grain is produced all over the world for export and how much some countries would be willing to import. But as long as our big corporations can continue to encourage production, like in countries like in Brazil, tear down the rainforest or the Cerrado, and actually put in investments like a port on the Amazon by Cargill, or the Japan subsidizes a railroad, or the World Bank subsidizes a road, or Monsanto encourages the use of Roundup-ready soybeans and corn, which will then allow the production of corn and soybeans in the rainforest. You know, what we export from this country has absolutely no bearing on my price whatsoever. And it'll just be farmers all over the world that will get lower and lower prices. And so that will result in fewer family farms, devastated rural communities, and the loss of local food supplies.
Let me then put this question to you. I'm sure people have asked it of you before. What makes a farmer different from somebody who is working in a different industry where they also find over time that prices are too low to sustain what they do? They have to diversify, they have to retrain, they have to go into a different business altogether. Is there anything different about farming?
Well, it's not very much different as far as the family farmer and a worker in one of these big industries. But as far as how that industry operates, it's completely different than a family farmer. When they're not able to sell so many cars or whatever, well, they downsize. They lay people off. They let society worry about what happens to those unemployed workers. Well, a family farmer doesn't have anybody that they can lay off. So consequently, and if they produce less, well, their income is for sure going to go down. So actually, family farmers, when prices go down, family farmers are going to maintain their production or even try to increase their production. And lots of times, that's at the expense of the environment. So to have farm prices go down, which is the system we have today with free trade, farmers are going to try to increase production, prices will go lower, the environment will be destroyed here in the United States and all around the world, and local food supplies and small communities, farm communities, will just go by the wayside. All of our food will be coming through an industrialized system.
George, we've got Tom on the line from Baton Rouge in Louisiana. He has a point he wants to make. Tom, yeah?
Yes, I'm calling from Baton Rouge, where there's a lot of sugarcane grown that wouldn't be grown if we didn't have agricultural subsidies. And I teach economics. I hope you had some economics at in your college education. And it seems to me that if we're going to reduce subsidies to poor single crack-addicted mothers, we should reduce subsidies to agricultural welfare as well. We are giving breaks in Louisiana, tearing up our roads to give sugarcane trucks an extra heavy weight exemption. When they burn the cane fields, we have asthmatic kids who get reactions adverse to it from the burning smoke of all the pesticide and fungicide and herbicide addicted farmers. None of that sugarcane would be grown, or very, very little of it, if we didn't have these enormous agricultural subsidies, most of which are going to the big corporate farmers. So I just assume, I'm sorry if it's harsh, but that is economics. I think perhaps you should get out of the business. You should at least consider the opportunity cost that you're engaging in when you're using this inherited land. You seem to differentiate that your costs were lower because you inherited yours compared to people who are renting. You should be bearing the cost of the foregone rent. If you calculated that into your...
Okay, Tom, there's the brutal economics of it, George. Looking at it simply from an economist's point of view, what you're doing makes no sense.
What he's referring to depends on a lot of political decisions. You know, why do we have great big huge sugar farms, and why are they allowed to pollute the environment? You know, those things should be covered by our environmental laws. And if we had had good farm policy through the years, we would have family farmers raising sugar in a sustainable, environmentally sound way. But that hasn't been the case because big agribusinesses, those big sugar companies, have dominated what the decisions have been made in Washington, D.C. and in our state capitals.
But, George, the key issue here is subsidies. Things are being grown, activities are being sustained because the subsidy is there.
Well, you could choose to lower subsidies to the point where we wouldn't raise any sugar in the United States whatsoever and be totally dependent on other countries to raise our sugar, if that's what you think would be good. And maybe that would be – maybe the caller would think that would be good for all of our food supply. The important thing to realize is that farmers around the world and other countries are coming to the conclusion that every country should have food sovereignty, and that there have to be political decisions made so that each country can make its own decisions about its farm and trade policy so that their policy respects their traditions, the opportunity cost of people having an opportunity to have a job or raise food in the countryside rather than always having to move to great big cities looking for jobs. And we don't, as a family farmer and president of the National Family Farm Coalition, I want to make it understood very clearly that we don't support big factory farms or industrialized production. But those things aren't going to be addressed by lowering subsidies.
Okay, George Naylor, for now, thank you. We're going to be coming back to you later in the show. George is a farmer from Iowa, obviously very concerned about the talk now of reducing subsidies to America's farmers. We're talking this hour about how to get trade back on track in this election year. How important are considerations about the country's farmers? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. I'm Robin Lustig. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig in for Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about trade and the future of American farming. Is government bailout the answer or the problem? And in this election year, how important is the American farmers' vote? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'd like to invite my other guests into the conversation now this hour. Chuck Hassebrook is the Executive Director of the Center for Rural Affairs, which represents the interests of family farmers. He joins us from Lincoln, Nebraska. And joining us from Washington, D.C., Mary Kay Thatcher from the American Farm Bureau Federation. Welcome to you both. Mary Kay Thatcher,
thanks for having us.
To you first, I think, in Washington. Do you see anything good in this outline agreement that's been reached by the World Trade Organization on subsidies?
We certainly do. Now, there's a lot of details yet to be worked out, but I think it's very important to note that had we not moved this framework forward, there was a good reason to believe that the Doha trade negotiating round, and for that matter, maybe even the World Trade Organization, the credibility was going to be questioned. And in agriculture, we believe that the WTO and reforming the processes of the subsidies, the tariffs, et cetera, is the best way to improve farm income.
But we've just been hearing from one farmer, from George Naylor, who sees potential disaster staring him in the face if these subsidies are reduced or removed.
Well, the subsidies that were agreed to be reduced in this negotiation will have absolutely no impact on farmers whatsoever because they were reduced from what's called the bound level. There's a ceiling that the United States cannot spend over that ceiling, the same for the Europeans and every other country. But we haven't been spending anywhere near that ceiling. So we and the Europeans both will take the 20% reduction if indeed we ever move forward with other proposals, because we don't give it up until the negotiations are finished in a couple of years. But there won't be any cut in farm support at all for the first 20%.
Let me make sure I understand you correctly here. What I understand you to say is that what is on the table now is a notional cut in notional ceilings. It's not real money in real farmers' bank accounts.
You're absolutely right. This was just viewed as a down payment from us, a good faith effort that we're willing to reduce our domestic supports if other countries reduce their export subsidies and their tariffs.
But you're saying to America's farmers, you won't notice any difference?
That's absolutely right. First of all, they couldn't notice any difference for a couple of years until the WTO negotiations are completed, because the 20% doesn't go into effect unless the negotiations are completed. And secondly, our ceiling is high enough now that that 20% cut will not affect their pocketbook.
Okay, Chuck Hasselbrook, how do you see it?
Well, I think that what really matters in this debate is where these trade discussions go. If they move forward and result in much deeper cuts, then it opens dramatic change to agriculture. And I think the real question is, what would replace these programs that would be cut if the trade talks move forward and make deep cuts?
But just staying on these cuts for one second, you see real cuts in prospect here, do you? Not just notional virtual cuts.
No, I see. I agree with Ms. Thatcher that these are cuts in the caps that were already below the caps, and so there's no immediate reduction in farm payments.
Okay, but looking further down the road, you see problems.
Well, further down the road, if these talks, as some would suggest, are just the beginning, and we're going to make much deeper cuts, then the impacts become much greater.
Let
Chuck finish, then I'll come back.
Sure. If what we do here is simply replace the programs we have now, or eliminate the programs we have now and don't replace them with anything, then the result could be a financial collapse out here. On the other hand, the programs we have now aren't working. I mean, we're losing family farms as fast as we ever have. These programs tend to be biased toward big farms. They subsidize the biggest farms to drive smaller farms out of business, their neighbors out of business. And if on the other side of it is if we use these trade talks as the occasion to replace programs that have a bias toward bigness with programs that are actually focused on strengthening small and medium-sized family farms, helping small businesses get started, revitalizing our communities out there, rewarding environmental stewardship, it could be a good thing. But I don't have faith that's where it's going to go, because that's not certainly the priority of the current administration or the current Congress.
George, come back in.
Yes, well, I think I could hardly believe what I heard, that this isn't going to result in any cut for farmers. So evidently this agreement is an agreement not to do anything. And yet all the other countries in the world, especially third world countries, are going to be have lots of pressure to let other farm products come into their countries and ruin their farm economies. And anyway, this whole thing is so hypocritical, this whole subsidy thing, because it's all based on very low farm prices, okay, so that farmers have to have subsidies just to stay in business, when in fact a farm program and trade policy should be based on making sure that these big corporations, Cargill, Continental Grain, etc., Tyson, should have to pay the full cost of production, not only the internal cost, but the external cost to our communities and to the environment. So we need international cooperation to put a floor under these farm prices so that farmers get a fair price, and we cooperate internationally to adjust production and to protect our environment.
I think, George, you're living in your own little world there. I mean, we live in a world market now, and we cannot expect the world to set a price for different commodities. And the idea of you saying, you know, you don't export any of your products, you just take it to the local elevator and maybe they do. You know, we only have 4% of the world's population that lives here in the U.S. So since we already export a third of our agricultural products, what kind of price is your local elevator going to pay you if we have no more export markets?
The world that buys my products is mostly rich people in Europe and Japan and other industrialized countries who have plenty of money to pay a lot higher price for our commodities and will be very happy to have a good supply of food that's quality food instead of industrial crap that's grown and processed by big corporations.
Okay, let's stop it just there because I want to open the conversation up and bring in some of our listeners at this point. Winton is on the line from Lowell, Massachusetts. Winton, hello.
Hello, how you doing, sir?
Fine, thank you. Now, how do you see all this?
All right, well, the way I see it is, one, first of all, I don't think any farmer deserves any subsidy whatsoever, period. That's at least my point of view. And then the way I see it is every country should be allowed to at least feed its own people. The other gentleman that you had on says he grows corn and something else.
Soybeans.
Yeah, and soybeans. But I can bet you right now he hardly ever eats corn or soybeans on a daily basis. When you go to the third world, say in southern part of Africa, the staple food there is corn. You eat corn in the morning, at lunch, and at nighttime. Okay, but you can't even grow it anymore because all these subsidies are causing such a big thing that everybody else is just dumping all this corn and all this cheap food on the third world, such that they can't even grow their own food, and then after that, they come back, they say, well, these African nations are not doing anything for themselves, but you can't even allow them to grow their own food because the WTO is owned by the same people who are supposedly giving us all these. It's a bunch of bull.
Winton, just a minute. You say no farmers should get any subsidies, period.
Not at all.
If that resulted in large numbers of farmers going out of business, where would you buy your food from?
That is fine. As far as I'm concerned, if no farmer got any subsidies, nobody would be unable to buy food. If anything, the food would probably be even be cheaper because it's cheaper to produce it in the third world country than it is to produce it over here. So if they cannot compete, they should not force the rest of the world to go hungry just so that they can keep their farmers over here.
Okay, so you're saying to Americans, if the food that's produced at home is too expensive, then buy your food from overseas.
Exactly. If that's the point, if we want to go into a globalized industry, then buy your food from overseas.
Let's put that to Chuck Hassebrook. Chuck?
Well, you know, I think that I think that there are broader interests here that we have to look at beyond the producer, that and it really comes back to the issue of the entire communities, the entire region out here. And when you talk about the need for subsidies, I think we need to look at what's going on out here, just the way we look sometimes at having an urban policy that deals with what goes on in the cities. When you look at our farm and ranch counties in our region, you find that we have poverty rates that are 50% higher than the region's metropolitan counties. We have average earnings that are 50% less than average earnings in the metropolitan counties. In fact, about 5 of the nation's 10 lowest income counties now are farm and ranch counties in rural Nebraska. So it seems to me that just as this nation made a commitment to turning things around when urban areas fail, that we need to have that same kind of commitment to our rural areas. Now, is the current policy working? Is just providing some subsidies on crops working? No, because it's what it's resulting in is simply subsidizing the big to devour the small and concentration in fewer and fewer hands. It's not serving the common good. It's serving a small elite. But what we need to have in this country is a policy about our rural communities that says that we want people to have genuine opportunity in our rural communities just as they do in metropolitan areas. And that means we need to shift away from subsidizing these big farms to supporting small and mid-sized farms. It means we need to start helping small businesses get started in these communities. We need to support stewardship of the land, but we need to support community development and support our communities, small farmers and mid-sized farmers as part of that. But that needs to be the focus. And much of the problem with our current policy is it's focused on serving the vested interest of very big producers and not helping create a future for our communities out here, which are dying.
Let's talk to Chip, who's on the line from Raleigh in North Carolina. Hello, Chip.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
There's a couple couple things. First of all, I totally agree that we need to stop any subsidies of large industries and large industrial complexes generating our food supply. I think that's a major problem and a major mistake. But on the other hand, the problem with the whole philosophy of the WTO and trade as far as food and agriculture goes is that if we go and buy our Walkmans from other places or any of our other consumables from other places, worst thing that happens if there's a war or there's a problem with a delivery where we don't have Walkmans to listen to or VCRs or DVDs. But if something happens to corrupt our food supply chain, which means either bioterrorism outside of our country in places we can't control and we can't monitor as well, or poor crop management because of an industrialized third world country or an industrialized agriculture in a third world country where they've got the big companies, you know, doing the crops and things like that, and then they find some problems with the genetic crops, and we bring them in, and all of a sudden it's too late. Our food chain's corrupted.
So you don't like what Winton was just saying to us a moment ago, that if American-produced food is too expensive, then just buy it from somewhere else.
Oh, that's just insane. It's a matter of national security. I mean, not only do we have the local farmers to take care of and the local communities, but the more we outsource that stuff and more we rely on the rest of the world for our food, I mean, like I said, consumables, VCRs, TVs, whatever, that's okay. We're not going to die over that. We're not going to have problems with genetics or any kind of problems with defects if we've got corrupted VCRs or TVs. But if we corrupt our food chain, you know, who knows what's going to happen down the road? Not only that, if there's a problem, we're not able to sustain ourselves.
Okay, so there's the argument then in favor of subsidies. It guarantees...
No, that's... Excuse me.
Yeah.
That's not an argument in favor of subsidies. Subsidies are substitutes for farmers getting a fair price. What we should have is getting a fair price so that big corporations can't buy these products so cheap. And every country should have the right to make sure that its farmers do get paid a fair price. As long as we stick with this subsidy system, commodities are going to be very cheap. Big corporations like Cargill and Tyson are going to raise all the animals in great big factory farms, and they're going to ship cheap commodities all over the world to destroy other countries' agricultural systems.
Now, Mary
Kay, that's the whole deal. Instead of subsidies, we need a fair price for farmers, and that's what we stand for at the National Family Farm Coalition.
I want to come back to Mary Kay Thatcher, because the argument seems to be that there is an imbalance within the industry, that too much of the help is going to the big corporations, not enough is going to the small farmers, and that the whole thing is coming out of kilter.
And that's simply not true. I mean, the example that these folks have given several times has been Tyson's and Cargill, and, you know, the livestock industry receives very, very little financial support from the federal government anyway. But I think we have to remember we live in a world market and we have consumer choice. We have things people want. For example, in this country, we import 100% of the coffee and the tea that we drink. We don't produce it here. We're not good producers. We don't have the right climates and soils. We import 80% of the seafood. Now, we import very little of our food. In fact, if you take out those things like coffee that we can't produce, we import less than 10% of our food. So we are very self-sufficient here. But I think the point that's also being missed is we're talking about these subsidies. There are three ways that countries help agricultural producers. Subsidies is certainly one of them. Tariffs or taxes are another. And in the U.S., we only have an average of 12% tariffs on the products that come in here. On the other hand, we pay 62% on average for products that go out. If we try to ship rice to Japan, they have a 450% tax on that rice. So, yes, we're going to be reducing domestic subsidies somewhat. Nobody knows how much. This deal is a couple years from being done. But in return, we're going to get those tariffs elsewhere reduced so that we can indeed export more and hopefully improve the prices that farmers are getting.
Chuck Hassebrook, good news as well as bad news.
Well, there's a mix of news here, but I want to come back to this point where Mary Kay Thatcher suggested that, in fact, these programs aren't disproportionately benefiting big farms. Look, the basic rule in the farm program is the bigger you get, the more money you get. We've got huge operations getting payments over several years of $40 million that they use to just get bigger, bid land away from small
and just spell out for us how that happens. That's because the subsidy is geared to the market price, is it?
Yeah, and it's basically geared to how much you produce. And so the bigger you are, the more money you get. And when these very large operations get more money, they turn around and reinvest that in bidding, increasing the bid prices they offer for land to grow and get more land, and they bid land away from the smaller farmers, and the smaller farms get forced out of business. It absolutely is what's happening with our farm program, and it needs to be addressed because there are good reasons to invest in public programs that create opportunity for people, that keep communities vibrant, that support food security, because all nations, I think, have a desire to be secure in knowing that they can meet their food needs and not be held hostage by other nations for their food supply. But there is no good reason. There is no good reason to have public programs that simply subsidize the biggest and richest, the biggest farmers and the richest landowners to drive smaller farms out of business. There is no legitimate purpose for that kind of a policy.
Mary Kay Thatcher, let's be completely open and honest about that. Isn't the truth of the matter that the big producers, the corporations, can survive without subsidies? The small and medium-sized ones can't.
Well, it depends on what you call large, and it depends on which commodities you're talking about. But you have to remember that we have what are called payment limitations in place, so that the maximum a farmer can receive in any year with all three of the domestic support programs is about $360,000. The millions and millions of dollars that Chuck references simply is not true.
Chuck?
Oh, I beg to differ. You should read the General Accounting Office investigation of payment limitation abuse, Mary Kay. You know full well that those payment limitations are just full of loopholes and that very large operations get around them all the time. In fact, NPR featured a report on a farm getting $40 million over several years a couple of months ago. We all know it happens. The payment limitations are full of loopholes. Abuses are rampant, and something needs to be done about it.
Let's just pause for a second, ask for more listeners to give us their thoughts here. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about trade and farm subsidies. If you grow food, even if you eat food, what are your thoughts about the idea that farmers could soon be getting up to 20% less in government subsidies? You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. This hour we're talking about the politics of trade. Are you hearing what you want to hear from the presidential candidates about trade issues, especially about those that affect the more rural and agricultural communities? My guests this hour are Mary Kay Thatcher, who's the Director of Public Policy at the American Farm Bureau Federation, Chuck Hassebrook, Executive Director of the Center for Rural Affairs. We're also joined by George Naylor, who's a farmer from Cerdan in Iowa. The number's for you to call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joan is on the line now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Joan, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I hope that the people who are making all of these plans and looking at this wider picture are mindful of what the situation is in the Midwest and all around the country in rural areas with fading farms. I have driven through parts of Kansas, for instance, where there's one empty, hollow farmhouse after another, and gone into county seats where the local antique fair is filled with the china cabinets from these farms that were abandoned or given up or sold. The original subsidies in the 1930s were established, as I recall my history, if I'm right, to ensure that the American people had a steady supply of good food and that the people who were working on the farms stayed on the farms producing good food. Now, we seem in all of this to have shifted our concerns for people elsewhere, and I am mindful of the problems in other parts of the world. But I think both candidates should consider what is best for the American farmer, and the American family farmer is being lost in all of this. The big companies are getting large subsidies and large payments, and the smaller farmer, however you size that, the smaller farmer is being forgotten.
George Naylor, do you feel forgotten?
Well, I tell you, I want to make sure that everybody understands that what is really good for U.S. farmers is the same thing that's good for farmers in Burkina Faso in Africa or Botswana or in Central America. The thing is that big companies generally aren't getting big subsidies, except when if you look at maybe sugar or cotton. The big problem is that the price of the commodities is too low, and the original farm programs that came into being in 1933 put a floor under farm prices, under corn and wheat, etc. And if you don't do that and prices go low, farmers have no alternative but to try to produce more. So the key ingredient here is that farmers get a price for their grain so that these big corporations have to pay for the food instead of the taxpayer.
But George, prices go low because that's what the market is prepared to pay,
don't they? Well, okay, let's see. If you were a farmer and the price went low, what would you do this next year? Would you try to cut back on your production or would you try to increase your production?
What's the most logical thing as a farmer to do?
Right. What's your answer?
Well, I'm not a farmer. You are.
Well, you don't have to be a farmer. You know very well that if you cut back production, your income is going to be less. So you wouldn't do that. You would try to increase more your production. So every farmer around the world is faced with that reality, and that's only going to make things worse, and it's only going to destroy the environment. And it's also going to provide cheap corn and soybeans so that Cargill and Tyson and IBP can produce more cheap livestock in confinement in big factories, which is really what is destroying the family farm. We have only one-fifth the number of hog farmers in Iowa that we did 10 years ago, and 80% of those hogs are either owned or controlled through contracts by big packing companies.
Okay, George. Well, talking of Iowa, our next caller is on the line from Des Moines. Ben is calling. Ben, let's talk politics for just a second. Both John Kerry and George W. Bush are in the state today, I think. Are they talking? Do you want them to talk about farm issues?
Well, I think they should, but I think they're going to be walking a fairly thin line, mainly because this is not a simple issue. I don't think it's not a question of subsidies or not subsidies. There's Ms. Thatcher and Mr. Hesselbrook are both making very good points about the large corporate farmers versus the smaller rural farmers. And what it boils down to me, economically, is no matter where you are, the margins are very slim in the industry. So when you have a slim margin, then it really comes down to what you can do with the raw dollars generated in that margin. And the bigger you are, the greater the size of that pool, that raw margin, once you multiply it. So,
Ben, do you farm yourself?
I grew up farming. My father bought his farm ranching operation, cattle, wheat, alfalfa, mint, and so on. And I stayed there and worked with him, of course, into my late 20s. Now I work in Des Moines, Iowa as a executive developer. But so I know the industry. But my main point is that my father, and I'm getting this mostly from him, mm-hmm. that he even when I was farming there and he was eligible for some of these subsidies, he didn't do it because he felt he's not a fan of welfare. He's a fan of producing what you can produce and making a living on it. And in a commodity-driven economic segment like agriculture, and with farmers not really willing to come together and be unified in how they approach this issue, it's hard for them to battle it.
Ben, you're there in Iowa. We're in an election year. You have both the candidates in the state today. Do you think these kinds of considerations, these kinds of issues, are likely to play a significant part in the way in which people in Iowa vote in November?
I would say, unfortunately, not on the macro scale, because as Mr. Naylor pointed out, the number of farmers is dropping so much that you end up having a bias toward the more urban voter, and I think that's a shame. But that's also why it gets back to this is not a very simple issue, because you can't, when it comes down to the raw vote, I mean just the straight vote, it may not cover the issue. It may come back to people, very capable people like Ms. Thatcher and people who are working at the government level to really be informed about this part of the economy, and then making decisions that best suit it. I mean, based on the European model of, if we go to war, the one thing we cannot afford to lose is our ability to eat, and so we have to maintain that. Now, should we leave that to the corporate farms, or should we help the rural farmer to keep stay in business?
Okay, now, Mary Kay Thatcher, I want to ask you about the politics of this. You served in the administration of the first President Bush, I think. How do you read the electoral politics of this whole issue?
Well, certainly rural America is going to be very important to both of the candidates. As you know from seeing the red and the blue map for the last few years, rural America tended to go for George Bush before. I think it's very likely that that will happen again. That's not to say they think he's a perfect person, but most farmers look at a Massachusetts senator who is essentially a clone of Ted Kennedy and say, how can that be good for agriculture?
Even if they see headlines in their newspapers, as some of them were over the last few days, saying farm subsidies to go to be slashed by 20%, does that impact on the way people vote?
I think it would impact if you believe that they're going to not figure out that that is not the truth. The fact is, farmers won't feel anything in their pocketbook from this 20% cut. And again, this 20% cut only takes effect a couple of years down the road from now if we get a final WTO agreement.
Okay, now you're from Iowa, aren't you? I think you still manage a farm there, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with Ben's reading of it, that in Iowa it won't probably be a huge issue?
I don't think it will be a huge issue in rural America, period, no.
Chuck Hasselbrook, do you?
I think it's a potentially huge issue if either party were to start addressing it effectively. You know, I think one of the reasons that these issues have really not influenced elections is that no party, frankly, neither party has consistently come forward with a clear plan of action to address the problems of rural America. And I want to broaden this discussion out.
Sure.
It includes farmers, but it needs to be broader. It needs to be the problems of rural America because, as I said before, in our farm and ranch counties, which include a lot of people who aren't farmers and ranchers, we have about 50% lower average earnings than in our metropolitan counties. Nobody's addressing that. But yet, when we look at what's going on in Congress in recent years and the spending cuts, we see that the Small Business Administration program that supports the smallest businesses, those with five or fewer employees, would be entirely cut in the administration's budget proposal.
You say nobody is addressing the issue. Nobody is looking at the continued viability of rural America as a whole, farmers and non-farmers alike. If you look at the industrial parts of the country, and you look what happened there when certain industries died, other industries eventually had to be brought in, had to grow up to take their place. Jobs change from one kind of job to another kind of job. Is that not likely to be the picture also in rural America?
Well, that's certainly a part of what has to happen in rural America. But just as in those large industrial areas, we need some government help making the transition. We need help in starting new small businesses because, in many respects, that's part of the future of rural America. In agriculture, we need some assistance in developing new cooperatives that help family farmers reach out and produce new products to sell to consumers who are willing to pay a premium for organic food or natural beef or natural pork or what have you. But the very programs, the very kinds of programs, small business development, cooperative development, conservation programs that help family farmers and rural communities transition to a future in the 21st century are being cut. And at the same time, absolutely no cuts are being made in sometimes multi-million dollar payments that subsidize mega farms to drive smaller farms
out
of business.
Okay, you talk about a transition. Might that be, in your view, a transition out of farming into some other kind of rural activity?
Well, like it or not, that's happening. I mean, we'd like to see, our work focuses on trying to keep as many opportunities as we can in farming and ranching. But the fact is that the greatest growth opportunity and where we put a lot of our effort is in small business development in these communities. So we're going to do what we can to try to keep as many opportunities as possible in farming and ranching, a lot of it through some new approaches like family farmers and ranchers getting together to produce for these higher value natural markets or what have you. But a lot of it has to be developing new small businesses, and we got to do both. We got to find ways to create genuine opportunity for rural people in these communities.
Mary Kay,
and Chuck,
that,
I think you're right about that. I mean, certainly, and George talked about his rural health care costs. You know, farmers are paying $10,000 a year for health insurance premiums. You know, you and I, who have a job and the company pays for it, we have no idea how expensive it's gotten. And I couldn't agree that we need to do more for the rural communities to work on rural health, rural development issues. But again, the fact of the matter is we're facing a half-trillion-dollar deficit. there just is not funding there to do some of the good projects that you talk about.
But Mary Kay, do you think that part of the message to small farmers might be, your day is gone, the future lies with the big producers?
Well, certainly we have trended to larger farms since the 20s and the 30s. I think we've trended to larger, a lot of type of businesses since then. But, you know, and certainly we've had people, as we talked about earlier, that have had to be two income earners. The wife has to go elsewhere and work off the farm. Sometimes the husband has to take a part-time job. We wish that wasn't the case, but we're competing with people around the world. It's very difficult for us when you go to some of the African countries in India, you look at what labor costs are, land costs, etc. We're going to have to compete with their ability to produce. We're going to have to be smarter than they are and get into niche products and value-added products. That's all into what Chuck talks about in the rural development arena. So I don't think their days are over. I just think we have to be smarter about what we produce and how we market it in the future.
I want to just bring George back in again, the farmer from West Central Iowa. George, we were talking about the politics of it.
Right.
Is your vote likely to change as a result of what you hear the candidates say on this issue?
Well, I'd like to offer another view. I think these farm issues are going to be a big issue in Iowa. After all, 85% of Iowans say there ought to be a moratorium on the building of big hog confinements, which are polluting our state and making it impossible to live in rural America.
And have you heard the candidates address that issue?
Yes, there's. I have, and I'd rather that the listeners go to their websites to see whether they support stronger environmental regulations on them and whether they support country of origin labeling so people know where their food came, and also whether they have a ban on big packing companies from owning livestock. And finally, the most important issue is what do these big hog confinement, these big animal factories pay for their grain and soybean meal. Now, I'd like to hear from both of the other guests on here, what are they going to do about low farm prices? Because that's the issue that every farmer around the world is focused on, low farm prices. It isn't subsidies, it's low farm prices.
This conversation will have to continue another day, another place. For now, I'm going to thank you all. George Naylor, president of the National Family Farm Coalition, Chuck Hazebrook, executive director of the Center for Rural Affairs, who joined us from Lincoln, Nebraska, and Mary Kay Thatcher, the Director of Public Policy at the American Farm Bureau Federation. She was in Washington, D.C. My thanks to you all. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection.